You're listening to the Bowman's Shipping Podcast, the show about everything and anything to do with ships, the law, and some stuff in between. I'm your host, Jeremy Prain, a shipping lawyer and partner at Bowman's, a leading African corporate and commercial law firm. Right now, it's difficult to escape the feeling that the world is in a state of turmoil, from economic volatility to climate change, not to mention the war in Ukraine. Closer to home, we have faced and continue to face our own calamities in South Africa. Here to talk to me about the disruptions which some of these have had on the supply chain and where possible opportunities lie in the future is my partner, Andrew Pike. Andrew Pike, welcome back to the Bowman Shipping Podcast.
Thanks, Jeremy. Thank you for the invitation.
Andy, today we're going to be talking about how a number of circumstances have converged over the past 2.5 years to cause significant disruption to the supply chain. To begin with, I think it might be useful to focus on the trifecta of COVID, civil unrest, and flooding in the Durban region. COVID is, of course, well understood, but it may be useful for the listeners to understand what happened in July last year with the unrest and the rioting in KwaZulu-Natal.
Yeah, so that was a pretty dark time in all of our lives in KwaZulu-Natal. And coming on the heels of COVID, which slowed down the supply chain significantly, the unrest caused utter mayhem. As listeners will probably know, there was an attack initially on shopping centers, and this spread from the epicenter to all parts of Durban and the sort of greater Durban area. And in particular, it came into the port area. So looters started attacking and climbing into containers. And in fact, there were all sorts of interesting stories about what was looted. And amongst other things was several million rounds of ammunition were looted from one or two containers in the port. And what that ammunition was doing there and where it went and so on, no one knows to date. Nothing was ever recovered. But very worrying that people knew that it existed, knew that it was there, knew that it could be taken. That put a huge stop to operations in the port and in the port precinct for, you know, it was 8 days of looting. And nothing could happen at that time. So port projects came to a halt, but also port operations. And the port itself declared force majeure. So you had ships sitting outside, you had importers and exporters who couldn't move their cargo, their goods. And on top of that, you had warehouses being attacked, set on fire, and generally the whole supply chain just grinding to a halt.
I recall seeing a number of major warehouses being badly damaged. That no doubt would have had an impact on the supply chain from a consumer goods perspective and other items.
Yeah, so the difficulty is that goods will come into Durban and go out, but let's just talk about incoming goods. So they will typically arrive at the port terminal in containers more often than not, and then be moved to holding areas, which would be the container depots, or else to warehouses where they will be de-stuffed, and then the contents of the containers will be moved to the hinterland via train or truck. What happens with a number of these imports is that they are done on a sort of just-in-time basis, and so you've got consumers in the hinterland who are waiting for goods, and you can't distribute them because they're stuck in a warehouse or they've been stolen. And so there's this whole knock-on effect down the supply chain all the way through to the consumer who's finally not seeing stuff on the shelves in the shops, or the factories who aren't able to manufacture whatever it is they were going to manufacture with the imported goods. So the problem is that, as with any chain, it's as strong as its weakest link. And if the weak link happens to be at the port or at the sort of back of port facilities, then the chain is broken and nothing can reach to wherever it needs to get to. And that's the problem with the supply chain, that you have to ensure that every link is strong and the integrity of the chain is maintained throughout.
The civil unrest was, of course, followed by some devastating floods in April this year. Can you tell us about those floods and their impact and perhaps even some of your own personal experiences?
Yeah, so the floods again created utter mayhem, and this time for a longer period. You know, once the civil unrest settled down, people managed to get going again, and within a few weeks things were back to normal. But the floods have brought a whole new set of problems. We had sustained rain over about 4 days, culminating in over 300 millimeters in the final 24 hours, which is almost half of Durban's annual rainfall in 24 hours. Everything was flooded, and particularly in the low-lying areas around the port. One of the major impacts was that the access road to the port, which is called Bayhead Road, which serves the container terminals, the dry and liquid bulk facilities, washed away. There's a place where Bayhead Road crosses a canal, and the two inbound lanes of Bayhead Road washed away. So where we used to have four lanes, two inbound, two outbound, suddenly we were down to two lanes. Apart from the fact that trucks and trailers and things fell into the canal and to this day haven't been salvaged, the more serious problem was that you couldn't get access to the container terminals or to those liquid and dry bulk facilities. And Bayhead Road is pretty congested at the best of times. So if you now take away two lanes, half of the route, you have a huge problem on your hands. There was a temporary workaround where the two outbound lanes were then reduced to a single inbound and outbound lane. Some emergency vehicles were allowed to then bypass and go through the suburbs, but because they are, of course, huge vehicles trying to move around in suburban roads, those were slowed down. The net result was that you had massive delays at all of the port facilities in the area. And because people couldn't reach for instance, the dry bulk facility, they then started redirecting their dry bulk inbound fertilizers and so on to Maiden Wharf, which, you know, has some facilities for handling in and outward bound dry bulk, but not many. And Maiden Wharf is a very congested area. So suddenly, where you used to have hundreds of trucks a day going to a specified dedicated area for the dry bulk, suddenly those were being redirected to Maiden Wharf. And Maiden Wharf does not have the road infrastructure to cater for all of those things. It was compounded then by warehouses in Maiden Wharf not having the capacity to take all of these trucks, and all of them coming over a single weighbridge. You know, suddenly you've got this competition for a weighbridge where you can have four trucks trying to get weighed in at the same time. Where the industry standard for a turnaround is probably 45 minutes for a truck to come in, get weighed, empty, fill up, go out and get reweighed and head off into the hinterland or go wherever it's got to go. Suddenly these trucks were taking 3, 4, 5 hours to get through the same process. And so you can just imagine how that then backs up on itself, where even at 45 minutes you've got queues of trucks. Suddenly you've got the entire precinct just flooded with trucks. In fact, what then happened was the truck operators, realizing that they were no longer profitable because they weren't doing a 45-minute turnaround, which would usually give them a number of truckloads in a day. They were suddenly saying, well, we're just not doing this work any longer. So suddenly there was a shortage of trucks to move the goods around. Now you compound that issue with the fact that there was a huge rail washaway between Durban and Cato Ridge, which is 40 kilometers inland. No rail could reach Durban. Nothing could leave or come in on rail. Now, there's a huge reliance on rail, particularly for containers, but also for other products. This required people trying to move those containers around to find more trucks in Johannesburg or wherever those trucks might be available. And so suddenly you've got even more trucks coming into a disaster zone as it is. I can't begin to explain just how this kind of knocked on to everything else, where you had people with goods stuck in warehouses for, to this day they're still stuck. And of course the warehouses are charging storage for this stuff, so you've got these huge additional costs which are mounting up. If you've got a warehouse charging, I don't know, pick a figure, 15, 20, 30 rand a ton per week for 50,000 tons of a particular product, you're talking about an extra couple of million. In fact, it's per day, it's not per week, an extra couple of million per day that is being incurred, and that has to be passed on to someone eventually. It's not going to be sucked up simply by the person who's imported it. He'll pass it on to his buyer and so on. Along the chain, you had people starting to declare force majeure, saying, we're not taking this and the loss must lie where it falls. But it's created a very complex matrix of issues and contractual disputes all the way along the line.
Yeah, we'll come on to the issue of force majeure in a moment. If we were to take a hypothetical situation, for example, thinking of how the landscape is at the moment, it's been now a year since the looting, which, you know, as you say, focused primarily on private warehouses and some back of port infrastructure, and then the floods, which no doubt have affected public infrastructure, roads, rail, port, etc. How would you describe a likely scenario of, let's say, a container of consumer goods coming into Durban from, let's say, China and making its way into the hinterland, possibly outside of our borders into southern Africa? What kind of issues are parties facing now that perhaps were not around pre-COVID?
If you just look at the sort of anatomy or the makeup or the route that a container would take, it'll arrive at the container terminal. Now, there are some systemic issues around the handling of containers in the Port of Durban, which I'm sure we'll talk about later. But already there are delays to the ship, so already there are implications of demurrage and so on for that ship. But eventually the container gets discharged into the terminal. Now you have to hope that a truck is going to come to the terminal and take that container away before it starts running up storage costs. And storage costs in container terminals mount up very, very quickly, because the idea of the terminal operator is to incentivize people to get them out so that they've got space to receive the next ship. You've got this issue of a truck struggling to get in because of the access road problems, because of the fact that you don't have rail now coming in or going out of the port. And so potentially that container importer is paying storage costs to the terminal. The truck might then come and move that container to a depot or a warehouse where it'll be unpacked so that the empty container can be given back to the owner of the container, the ship owner typically, and the goods can be then moved back to the hinterland. Now, during the floods, many, many warehouses and depots were completely trashed. I had one client talking about 2 meters of water coming through their depot, 150 containers collapsed. I saw a particular depot near the old airport where probably 3,000 containers had collapsed because they simply started floating, and many of those containers floated out onto the highway. And it was a sort of scene from Armageddon when you drove through there. So there's a shortage of container depots, and only some depots are still operating fully. Not all of them are back on their feet properly. Again, you've got issues with the container depots which are operating being clogged up with inbound and outbound traffic, and being run off their feet because there is now a shortage of depots elsewhere. But in any event, let's assume our container finally makes its way into a warehouse or a depot. It gets de-stuffed. A truck finally gets there, but once again, you've got a run on storage costs and things for that because the trucks can't get in. And then it's got to go off to the hinterland. It goes by truck. If it was going by rail, it would be going quicker and probably cheaper. So you've now got an increased cost of trucks. Trucks themselves are charging a premium because of the delays in Durban. So we're hearing about trucks which are sometimes taking up to 10 hours to pick up a container from the container terminal simply because they cannot get in there and they can't get out again. So the truck owner, instead of doing his 5 or 6 loads a day and moving them to a local depot or warehouse, can only do one. He's got a 2 million rand rig that he's got to finance, and he can't do it at a few hundred rand a day. So either he's got to ramp up his costs hugely to move one container, you know, or you've got to make some other plan. And there are very few other plans that can be made. So all along the chain, you've got these additional costs. Once you get out of Durban, you know, these trucks will then run on the roads, and they'll mostly be fine all the way through to Johannesburg or wherever they've got to get to. But the real issue is around the Durban precinct and the mess that it's making in moving that container through the system so that it can get onto the road and out to its end consumer.
If we consider the converse, so of course South Africa is a major exporter of hard commodities, coal being a good example, but there are a number of others. Some of that is shipped out of, the majority, I imagine, is shipped out of Richards Bay. Some is shipped out of Saldanha on the west coast. And no doubt a little is shipped out of Durban, which is now being affected. So let's imagine the same hypothetical situation, but from the perspective of an export.
Okay, so let's just take a load of coal that needs to get out of either Richards Bay or Durban. But let's start with Durban. So we have a dry bulk export facility. It doesn't move the volumes that you see in Richards Bay. But you can't get it there by train, so trucks have to come in. And usually there are trucks which drive into the key point area at the Bluff. The difficulty is that product, coal, let's say, gets stored at the coal facility there. But because it's coal, it has a lot of fines that run off. Those get flooded, and every time it rains, they get flooded. The drainage can't cope with it, so you suddenly have your bulk commodity sitting in huge pools of water. And we had one particular instance, it wasn't coal, it was a different commodity, where the contractors at the bulk facility loaded not just the product, but also many, many tons of water onto the ship. That created a problem because when bulk cargoes are of a particular fineness and they're wet, they tend to liquefy. And that is basically a system where water rises to the surface of the product. And you now have a free surface effect inside a ship. And there have been many unexplained instances of ships simply capsizing out of the blue where the cargo liquefies while the ship is at sea because of the movement of the ship. And so if you put a whole lot of water onto a ship with the bulk cargo, ship's masters are far more alive to this issue of liquefaction now. They will say, we're not taking this, take my cargo off. And to take a cargo off a ship is a lot harder than to put it on, particularly if it's a facility which is designed for exports and not imports. You know, the particular case we saw recently, which was directly related to these floods, was just that, where the ship was delayed for weeks and weeks in trying to get the cargo off and the bulk facility trying to dry out their bins. That's been a problem. And then, as I say, simply with the congestion, trucks are just not wanting to deliver to that bulk facility. Further north, you've got Richards Bay, and that's sort of more obvious place to export because they weren't hit by the floods. But they've got their own issues because Transnet's rail line to Richards Bay is fraught with all sorts of issues, cable theft and the other problems that the Transnet are beset with. As a result, you having ships that are waiting outside Richards Bay to come in and collect cargo from the multi-purpose terminal, they're waiting for up to 30 days. And 30 days is a ridiculous amount of time. You know, that's $1 million in hire that's got to be paid by someone, or in demurrage, shall we say, that's got to be paid by the exporter or by the charterer of that ship. You know, where is that $1 million coming from? Well, once again, some consumer somewhere in the world is going to be paying for that extra $1 million of carriage. The Richards Bay Coal Terminal is more efficient in getting its ships in and out, but nonetheless, they are having problems in the fact that the cargoes are battling to reach Richards Bay because of the rail problems. We have some issues with our supply chain, no doubt about it.
You mentioned Transnet, of course, which sits at front and center of a lot of this, because that is the state-owned enterprise that is responsible for ports and terminals, rail infrastructure, etc. They, it seems, find themselves in the enviable position when these disasters strike, and typically one finds that the knee-jerk reaction is to declare force majeure, as we mentioned earlier. And I think for many listeners, both in South Africa and abroad, the concept of force majeure is often not very well understood, certainly from a legal perspective, and what the implications are. So perhaps to set the scene, you can explain to us, you know, from a legal perspective, certainly in South Africa, what does force majeure actually mean, and what are the implications of it?
Force majeure is usually a term that you find in contracts, which describes a number of things which make the performance of obligations impossible. So we have a common law concept, which is more like an act of God, but that would be restricted then to weather issues and earthquakes and fires and things like that. Force majeure is a contractual concept which goes much wider, and that can include the exclusion of liabilities for failure to perform obligations for things like war and strikes and looting, quite frankly. Anything which is beyond the reasonable control of the parties involved in the contract and which wasn't foreseeable at the commencement of the contract. So most contracts, and particularly in the supply chain, will have this concept of force majeure, which excuses someone from performing their obligations. And what that means is that losses tend to lie where they fall. The difficulty is that you have a chain of contracts all the way down the supply chain. The supply chain is about relationships at every single stop, at the container terminal, at the depots, on the road, the trucks, the rail, warehouses. Everyone has a relationship with someone, and the relationship is informed by the contractual terms, whatever those look like. And they might look like standard trading conditions or throughput agreements, offtake agreements, whatever they may be, warehousing agreements and so on. And in many of those, you'll find this concept of force majeure. Because it's a contractual thing, it's not always written in the same terms. And sometimes it talks about losses which are caused directly because of force majeure. Other times it's a much wider concept where indirect losses or indirect force majeure is applicable. So if you look, for instance, at the flood scenario, there were probably 6 to 10 days where no one could move because of the floods and the flood damage. But then things slowly started picking up, and where you might have had 50 or 100 trucks calling at a facility in a day, suddenly you've got 20, but something's happening. So the question is that still force majeure? Or can you only claim force majeure for the time where no trucks were calling? So there are all of these complications to force majeure. But when you have a disaster like this, you will find people starting to declare force majeure down the chain. It's something that typically starts at the Transnet level. The port itself will say, we've got COVID, we're not allowed to handle any goods, we're declaring force majeure. And so the next person in the chain will say, well, we're also declaring force majeure because they have. And, you know, the question is, can you sort of 3, 4, 5 stages down the line declare force majeure relying on the first person? But in any event, What we have seen is a number of these force majeure declarations over the years in the port, from COVID, from the looting, from the floods. Those are the typical ones. And on the rail, we've had this very controversial force majeure declaration by Transnet Freight Rail, where they told most of the coal exporters out of Richards Bay that they couldn't provide trains because of cable theft and vandalism, typically, and essentially maintenance issues around the rail line. And so the question is that a valid force majeure declaration or not? And I know that a number of the traders and mines have said, we just don't accept that. That is within your control. It's a security issue. You haven't managed the security around your infrastructure. And why should we have to pay for that? And so force majeure, just because someone says it, doesn't always mean that it falls within the four corners of the definition in the contract.
The issues that you've described obviously paint a relatively bleak picture. And of course, the world at large is suffering from possibly similar kinds of issues, but perhaps for different reasons. But there's obviously been a huge squeeze on the logistics chain. We've seen increase in fuel prices, sort of rampant inflation, etc. Suppose we shouldn't be too hard on ourselves as a result. One of the things that I think possibly offers an opportunity or a silver lining is that we have seen, to an extent, a policy shift from the South African government to liberalize or, to an extent, privatize port, terminal and rail operations across the country. And you'll recall that in our previous podcast, we spoke about the corporatization of the Transnet National Ports Authority. And for those listeners who haven't listened to that podcast, I would encourage you to go back and have a listen to that. It's very, very useful. But Andy, could you give us a snapshot of, you know, where we are at the moment in these moves towards liberalization and where matters currently stand vis-a-vis the TNPA?
Jeremy, when we spoke about corporatization, it seemed imminent. We'd seen a number of announcements from government and various initiatives. Since then, quite frankly, not much has happened. It is still, however, very much on the table. It's not clear to the public, or certainly not to me, what the delay is, because when we last checked, the company, the new SPV, which will be sort of Transnet Port Authority Pty Limited, had not even been formed. So it's not clear what's happening or why there's this delay. But having said that, we are seeing a number of privatization initiatives which will liberalize the sector quite significantly. There's no doubt in my mind that you need a basket of initiatives in order to achieve what the government wants to achieve, which is to try and kickstart or give impetus back to the economy by securing the logistics sector. So it will happen, but we really don't have any particular timeline on the Port Authority privatisation process.
As you said, there have been some moves, some positive moves, and you know, I am aware of some publications for RFPs and RFQs in relation to specific sort of cherry-picked projects. Could you tell us a little bit about those?
Perhaps I can just give a context, first of all. Last year, the World Bank came out with its first container port performance index. In that index, they looked at ports around the world, 350 of them, and measured their performance in relation particularly to delays to cargoes and services in those ports. And the South African ports fared particularly badly, three ports, Cape Town, Durban, Kucha. In fact, if I'm not mistaken, I think Cape Town might have been the worst performing in that whole list of 350. This year, a new index came out, covering 2021. There are now about 370 ports, and again, the South African ports are in the last 10 of those. So performance on any basis is pretty poor in South Africa, and it's not clear whether the problem arises from, you know, lack of equipment maintenance, whether they are management issues, but it doesn't particularly matter. The fact is that we aren't performing. Now, at quite an encouraging level, earlier this year, two RFPs came out from Transnet. This is the SOC itself, not from the Port Authority. The RFPs are in respect of Durban Container Terminal Number 2, DCT2, and the Noche Container Terminal. And the idea is that an investor will come in and take over the business of each of those terminals. The business will be put into a special purpose vehicle, an SPV. The investor will have management and control of that SPV. Presumably, Transnet will retain a minority stake, but the investor will then take over, finance, and manage those container terminals. From what we've seen, all of the big guys have come out to play here. We're seeing some very big names in the container and port operations world who have shown an interest. And in fact, we heard that there were 19 people who were given RFP or RFQs, requests for qualification, by Transnet. So the RFQ phase is over, and everyone is waiting to see who will be given an RFP. And we expect that there'll probably be five or six of the major players who are given RFPs. And the idea is that they would bring in investment funds, which would help upgrade any old equipment. They would introduce new equipment. But more importantly, they would introduce management systems, IT systems, and so on, which would all go to bring back those container terminals to the standards at which they should be operating. And what was interesting in the RFQ was that there were particular qualifying performance matrices that were required. So anyone who wants to qualify has to demonstrate that they're already operating a certain number of terminals somewhere in the world and that they're meeting particular performance matrices. That is a clear indication that these are about performance and upping performance. What's quite interesting with the Durban one, which is the sort of, which I think will be the real prize for any winning bidder, is that they will then be given an option to develop another container terminal, a greenfield terminal in Durban as well. Those are great initiatives, and I'm pretty hopeful that those will make a difference. A, that they'll come to market very quickly, and B, that they will make a difference. There are two others that I wanted to mention. The one is Transnet Freight Rail have put a number of slots out to tender, container slots for the Johannesburg or the Gauteng Durban corridor, and then for also a corridor down to the Eastern Cape. What's strange about this, though, is that the slots are only being put out to tender for 2 years. No one has a train set which they can put onto these rail lines, and no one would be willing to make that sort of investment for a 2-year spell. So I don't know what they're trying to achieve with that, but I'm pretty confident that one, they will get no bidders unless there's someone earmarked that already has a train set and this has been tailored to that person. But I'm not aware of anyone who has something available to put on those lines. So I'll be surprised if that comes off. But quite frankly, it's the right move, but the wrong concession period. Hopefully, if they get no response, they will then rethink that. One of the other initiatives is a LNG terminal, which is proposed for Richards Bay, with vast quantities, which I suppose will eventually come on stream from Mozambique. It makes sense to create a terminal, and it will be a privately owned and operated terminal. We've seen an RFP for an offshore supply base in Saldanha, which is still running its course. In fact, it's been awarded, but the concession is still being implemented. So there are a number of initiatives, and definitely this move towards privatization. It's a realization by a government or Transnet or whoever that they simply cannot do it on their own without support from the private sector.
Do you think the current pressures that we've been discussing today, I imagine to an extent, are coincidental at the same time as the government's development plan with new initiatives towards privatization? But I wonder, do you have a sense that perhaps the current environment has in a way accelerated the move by the government?
Yeah, I think that must be right. I agree with you that I think that these are coincidental, that they were on the cards already some years ago. And I do think, though, that your observation is correct, that you know, these were to focus people's attention on just how serious the issues are that we have to deal with. And so there will be a greater urgency to get them across the line. I'm quite sure about that. Yeah. So, you know, I don't want to be naive in my optimism, but I am really hopeful that within the next, I don't know, 2 years, with any luck, if this RFP goes ahead, we should have things working a lot better and, with any luck, get off the bottom of that World Bank index.
Andy, you were personally involved in the legal side of the project for the concession granted to Mediterranean Shipping Company to conduct and operate a cruise terminal at the Port of Durban. Do you think that this project provides a useful blueprint? I mean, as regards future projects and how the relationship between Transnet and the private sector could interact?
Yes, Jeremy, I think that project has been a great success. What was available at the port prior to this project was pretty much a shed, and it was not what you would expect as a world-class facility for international passengers arriving and leaving from Durban. MSC wanted this facility particularly for their own ships because they call extensively along the South African coast, but also as a gateway to South Africa that would really look and be world-class. And that's what they did. Transnet were open to it and realized they couldn't do it themselves. After quite a lot of work, the model was finally figured out. And we now have a world-class facility in Durban, which, honestly, if you could create a few more of those, you would suddenly have Durban as a shining light in the region, as it used to be, quite frankly. What the cruise terminal has shown is that you can have a successful triple P between the state logistics network and private parties. I think that was a good learning curve and will probably work very well in informing how the container terminal privatization goes about. You know, whether that can be extended to the rest of the sector, I don't know, but certainly within the port, we have something that is working, that has worked, and there's no reason why it shouldn't work for other initiatives.
So just to close out on, what advice do you have for port, road, rail users who are operating in this environment from a risk mitigation point of view?
Part of the problem with risk mitigation in the logistics sector is that it's not always foreseeable. And certainly the floods were never foreseeable, COVID wasn't foreseeable, and the rioting wasn't foreseeable. For a start, you've got to almost think, you know, to use a cliche, well outside the box and say, you know, what is it that we are planning for that we have not foreseen and that we're not expecting? And the only way you can do that is to make sure that your paperwork is right for a start. You've got to ensure that you've covered your bases, covered your force majeure clauses, and done a proper assessment of all of your risks before you take on a particular project or start moving your stuff around. What are the links in the chain that I have to go through, and how do I get past each of those links in a way which ensures that my cargo gets to its ultimate destination unscathed without malting me in delay costs and, you know, unforeseeable fuel increases and so on. So you've almost got to do a full risk assessment of the entire chain along which your cargo is going to move. And you're going to say, you know, when I move it from China to South Africa, who's going to pay for the ship? And what happens if the ship is delayed when it arrives? And when it's in the terminal, am I sure that my truck is going to get there on time? And am I sure that my warehouse is going to be available when the container has to be de-stuffed in the warehouse? And if not, have I got a plan B if that warehouse isn't available? you require this full and careful risk assessment. You've got to look at what are the probabilities of a particular risk arising, what's going to be the impact on me of that risk if it does arise, and how am I going to mitigate it. A lot of it will be contractual mitigation. By the same token, a lot of it is just careful planning, ensuring that you've got the right service provider who is reliable, dependable, and will deliver the service that you need. So you have logistics providers in the chain. Pick the right one. Don't pick the cheap one, because the cheap one isn't necessarily the right one. Just ensure that you are partnering with the right people along the route and that your paperwork secures you. There's no quick and easy answer other than to be very methodical in working out where your likely weaknesses are and how you're going to spare yourself some pain.
Well, Andy, I look forward to our discussion hopefully this time next year, where one hopes that the picture will be a bit rosier and we'll have better news to tell. But there's some food for thought there, some sobering analysis, but also opportunity, no doubt, as these situations always provide. So thank you very much.
Thanks, Jeremy.
That's it for today's episode. You can follow us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. And please feel free to leave a rating or review. Until next time, thanks for listening.